Okay, it's Stacey Deschau and Kate Purdy, Matt Shapiro, and Darren Sprawls here with you for more of Life Wife. Today we're going to be talking about the Hive House community that Stacey and I have built over the course of a year and a half or so, starting in 2014. I would say around June 2014.
Yes, I recall it was a beautiful June day full of love and friendship.
Birds were singing.
The sky was exciting.
Friends were screaming.
The sky was so exciting.
So we're here at the Hive House for our Summer Solstice Crafts Fair, and we also have musicians playing, so it's a summer fair. And there are several vendors, each of them selling a homemade product. And I am selling these body salves that Stacey and I made with her mom for Super Bowl Sunday.
I'm Lindsay, and I made some kombucha today, and I'm selling fresh kombucha, just done brewed yesterday.
My name is Tyler Hayden. I draw a lot. I've got some postcards and a mini comic and some thank you cards.
I like face painting because I think people need to stop worrying so much about their appearance and just kind of enjoy the moment, enjoy having a rainbow on their arm, enjoy having a third eye on their face, whatever is happening at that particular time. It'll wash off, you know. Life is temporary, the face paint is temporary.
Yeah. Well, I moved in close to Stacey in March of 2014, which was a dream come true. There was this big old broken down mansion.
Yeah.
That was haunted.
Yes. It was haunted.
Three houses down from Stacey.
Yeah, and it was, I think, the oldest house on the street.
100 years old. Built in 1906, so then in 2016, and it turned 100.
Mm-hmm.
And the family that rented it to me had owned it for 30 years. I think they bought it in 1964 for $11,000, is what someone told me that they read on Zillow.
That's amazing.
Yeah, and a lot of property up on a hill. Interesting place.
Yeah.
Not
far from downtown.
Not far from downtown.
Nice.
Because I guess they had bought it for so little money and had it for so long, the rent was pretty low, which was good. And it kind of afforded us to have this community, like to really think about it as a community space.
Right. Yes.
So Stacey and I have been hosting community events at the house, and it's been really fun. They've been all kinds of different events, a lot of times with live music, with friends reading different personal essays they've written.
Yes.
We had a ceremony for the bees.
Yes, that was so nice.
We've celebrated Eleanor Roosevelt in several different ways.
She's always in our heart and our spirit.
We had a birthday party for her with feminist readers.
Yes, who are all male feminist readers.
Mm-hmm. And we actually have Steve Basselin was one of our readers. He's a writer on the Goldbergs.
And he was great.
He wrote and he wrote and read a piece about his mother. And our friend Matt Temple stood up and talked about his daughters.
Yes.
And our friend Emily Lacey played some music.
Yes.
Stacey said yes.
Yes.
Thank you. It's a great night to be a feminist. Not every night that you get to come to a feminist-themed event, so thanks for having me. So, as you can see, I am just one measly little soul, but you are many, and I need your help. So I'm gonna teach you this song, and then you're gonna sing with me. okay, so there's an old song, Michael, Row Your Boat Ashore. And I was actually asked to sing at an event for the Women's Center for Creative Work about a year ago. And I went ahead and changed it to Mary, Row Your Boat Ashore. And so I'll teach you how it goes.
ferry row your boat ashore. Hallelujah. Mary row your boat ashore. Hallelujah.
So you see, you'll hear me the first half, and then you'll be like, oh yeah, I totally want to sing that. So I'll go.
Mary row your boat ashore. Hallelujah.
And then you'll go.
Mary row your boat ashore. Hallelujah.
That's right. All right, let's try it again. Don't be shy. It's only going to get more awkward if you're shy.
Mary row your boat ashore. Hallelujah. Mary row your boat ashore. Hallelujah.
I really can't hear you. And it's for every verse in the song. There's about 7 verses, so pace yourself.
Sister, help and trim the sails. Hallelujah. Sister, help and trim the sails. Hallelujah.
That's right.
Mary row your boat ashore. Hallelujah.
next up, we have Steve.
This is actually the third Eleanor Roosevelt event I've spoken at today. So, in the spring of 1974 in Pittsburgh, my mother took a job in the sales department of a Fortune 500 company. She was young, just 23 years old, but she was excited about the prospect of the job. While she hadn't made it through college, she was driven and articulate and thought the position was something she could excel in. And she did excel. My mother was always a natural salesman. She was charming and warm when she needed to be, and shrewd and downright intimidating when the situation called for it. And that she bared an uncanny resemblance to Meryl Streep didn't hurt either. But after being at the company a short while, she began to realize she wasn't being compensated fairly, making far less than her male counterparts. On several occasions, she brought this disparity to the attention of her supervisors, but of course, her words fell on deaf ears. For most, that would have been it. They would have chalked it up to just being the norm, perhaps felt frustrated, but moved on. My mother, on the other hand, was not one who was prone to giving many, if any, fucks at all about the norm. She didn't care that it was her first job, or that she was just 23 in an entry-level position in a behemoth of a company, or that it was 1974. She was upset. Upset that she was being underpaid, sure, but more importantly, that she was pissed that she was being ignored. My mom did not like to be ignored. To her, the situation was unacceptable, so she did the only thing she could think to do when something was unacceptable. She wrote a letter. She sat down and composed a sternly worded message explaining her intolerable work situation. The next morning, she stuffed the letter into an envelope and sent it not to her boss, not even to her boss's boss, but rather to the president of the entire company. At the end of the letter, she curtly wrote that she would call him in 1 week's time to resolve the matter. My mother was only 23 years old, just a kid, really. And here she was writing to the head of a multi-million-dollar company simply because she was being treated unfairly. She never got to call the president, however, because by the week's end, she'd already been compensated for the disparity. Sure, she earned the ire of her immediate supervisor, but she didn't care because she'd earned the respect of everyone else. And from that point forward, she was never ignored. That's a story that my mom told me over dinner in an empty restaurant on 3rd Street just 2 months before she passed away last December. I knew she didn't have much time, as she had been diagnosed with stage 4 small bowel cancer the summer before. But the thing about time is, you always think you have more of it. This is a point that I was keenly reminded of as I sat down to write this essay just a few hours ago. As she told me the story of her first real job, seeing the indignation in her furrowed brow, then seeing the spark of vindication in her eyes as she stated, "Those sons of bitches never ignored me again," I had this surge of fear wash over me. This was such a huge story. It was such a triumphant and hilarious tale indicative of the ballsy and complex woman my mother was. And it was one that I almost never knew, a memory that almost died along with her because I had never heard it. As she took a sip of her Cosmo, she was that kind of mom, I felt a tightness in my chest, knowing that these moments where we'd get a little too boozy and talk not just as mother and son, but as friends, well, they were fleeting. But we still had that night. So I ordered another round and dug in. She reminisced about growing up, telling me all the pitfalls and perks of being the oldest of 9 kids. She talked about her first marriage in her early 20s, how Danny was a nice man, but that it never really worked, and she was in the process of leaving just as he was in a terrible car accident. So instead of leaving, she set up shop in the hospital, and over the next 9 months, slowly helped him get his life back. We talked about my childhood and how she recalled how hard it was to leave me to go back to work when I was a baby, but that it was always important for her to work. I asked her what it was like going vegan for 2 years in the mid-80s in Pittsburgh. I don't know, they still serve French fries on every salad in Pittsburgh, so it was not an easy task. She laughed and said it was damn near impossible, and her family made fun of her the entire time, another large Irish Catholic family, but it was important to her, so she just did it. It was the same way with starting a Montessori school for me in 1987. She didn't like the education options I had available to me, so she rounded up a few other women and just started a school. It didn't matter that it was a school devoted entirely to an Irish-based curriculum that she knew nothing about. Again, it was important, so she just did it. And that school still stands today, now with well over 100 kids enrolled. It's a big point of pride for her. She also spoke of her marriage to my father, how they had fun, but much like her first husband, it never really worked. He was a good man, but he made it clear that he was always going to come first, and that just wasn't enough for her. She explained how hard it was to feel alone with a young child, and that some winter nights, after they'd fought, when she couldn't sleep, she'd bundle me up in her car seat, get on the highway, and just drive and cry and stare down the vast expanse of black asphalt. Until finally exhausted, she'd turn around and drive home, sleeping only moments before setting off for another job where, much like the one she had when she was 23, people learned that she was a force to be reckoned with. I asked her questions about her experience as the president of Zonta, a worldwide organization of executives working to advance the status of women, and the time my mom took in her sister just after she'd given birth to her first child because my aunt and her husband were having problems. We spoke of responsibility, and she told me why she always tried to expose her nieces and nephews to things they'd never experience. Things like theater, or ethnic food, or even plane travel. Or how, when she had given me a camera for my 17th birthday, but she stated that I could only use it if I made strides to use the phrase wife beater less when referring to undershirts. We also spoke of patience and acceptance. How my mother managed to move past her anger when my wife, Lauren, came out and announced she was gay. How she was able to see the humanity and vulnerability in my wife when others, including myself, were struggling to do so. And how she was able to continue loving her as a daughter after she very clearly expressed to Lauren what facet she was angry about. Or simply how my mom managed to maintain such grace and calm even while staring down the overwhelming magnitude of the reality that lay on the horizon for her. We talked about all of it in a darkened, empty restaurant, me trying to soak up as much as I could before the source would run dry. 2 months later, I was sitting in a hospital room in New Haven, stroking her hair and talking to her as her chest rose and fell between short, belabored breaths. She had stopped being responsive days before, but we both listened to the George Winston piano trills that I had playing from my computer as I reminisced with her about this and that. This trip to Florida, that time we made Thanksgiving dinner in my tiny apartment in LA. It was just me talking, but it was a dialogue that seemed to soothe both of us. Then I came to a point in a memory where I couldn't recall where her first apartment was. I turned to my aunt, the one she'd taken in so many years before, who dozed in the chair beside the bed. Was it the apartment in Shadyside, or had she already moved to North Hills? Neither of us could remember. It was a small detail, inconsequential really, but again I could feel the tightness in my chest, knowing that this was to be just one of many details that would be lost, that would be blurred and faded by time like an old Polaroid, that would be restored to just molecules of energy once her chest stopped rising and falling. In the months since she's passed, I've come to head with so many of these instances, visages of her that are just flashes of an image and no longer fully fleshed out memories. But here is what I do know, what I still and will always remember about a woman who was as steadfast in her kindness as she was in her convictions. Joyce Wallace Bazelon was the biggest feminist I've ever known. But not because she was always on a soapbox shouting about equality, but because she was always out in the world demanding it. Demanding the best for herself and for all those around her. Because anything less than that would be unacceptable. And if it was unacceptable, well, then Mama was going to have to write a letter. Thanks, guys.
If anyone has any questions or things they want to share, or if they read any quotes from Eleanor Roosevelt today that they want to talk about, or if there are women in your lives you want to talk about. And also, if you don't, that's okay, too. Matthew Temple.
Hi, guys. I'm going to go out on a limb and say I'm probably the only person here with four teenage daughters. When I was 20, I had my first, and I had no idea that at that point I knew what it meant to be a feminist. Well, let me put it this way. I knew what a feminist was, but I had no idea what that actually meant. And how that's actually grown and changed over the last now 18 years. Because really that's changed from something that was completely sort of theoretical to something that has become deeply personal, and kind of moved back and forth. And as I was raising daughters, and when we moved back to LA about 10 years ago, really sort of this really stark reality of what it meant to be a young girl. Not, let me take that back, not what it meant to be a young girl, but the perception of what it was to be a young woman in LA was really, really difficult, and always brought this like serious anger up in me, like, this is unfair. But then as they got older and I got to see who they were becoming and how they were blossoming in spite of this, in spite of sort of what was coming against them, two things shifted. One was what an amazing time it is to be a young woman in the world with all of this potential and all of this, you know, all of the Eleanor Roosevelts that came before, and there's sort of this moment where something seemed to be shifting. And that anger and confusion in some ways actually evolved into not a being angry on behalf of these young women, but a pity on behalf of the men who are not a part of making that the current paradigm different. And then watching as they were able to really as they've grown and to be able to actually transform things that come at them as a negative and be able to just with a smile and with a laugh kind of let it go and keep going with their lives and realizing that that negativity is actually being transformed by their strength and by their joy. This last summer, my two oldest daughters were backpacking alone around Europe, an 18-year-old and a 16-year-old. And while they were off having an amazing time, and my oldest called me at one point, and she's like, so I was going to go do all these other things, but I met this boy, and I'm going to go to Greece and spend a week with him. I was like, oh, cool, tell me about him. She says, well, he's 26. You're not mad, are you? And I said, well, are you having fun? Yeah. Is he treating you well? Of course. Okay, well then, there's nothing to be mad about. And she had this amazing time and came back. And while she was gone, I took my 15-year-old twins up and we did a 60-mile backpacking trip through the Sierras. And about halfway through, less than halfway through, it started raining. We had 5 days of hail and thunderstorms and rain. And we were soaking wet and close to the end of the first day of the rain, and I'm getting frustrated, and I'm going to turn around and say to them, oh my God, this is terrible. As I'm literally, the words are about to come out of my mouth, they just looked, both of them said, isn't it so beautiful up here when it rains like this? To me, that little moment sort of encapsulated who they were and who they can be, and how all this other stuff that the work that all the people have come before have kind of laid this groundwork to where the difficulties have actually become some of the stuff that's made them stronger. And so it's really kind of a thank you to everybody who would come tonight, and Eleanor and Kate for putting this on, and the beautiful words that came before. That's the stuff that we're actually building on.
Yeah, so a lot of big changes have happened, including I had to move out of the place.
Yes.
Of our physical Hive House place. And I would say the reason for that, the primary reason for that, was that the landlords who were in their 80s and had owned that house since, I think, 1964, mm-hmm. handed it off to their son and daughter mm-hmm. to manage, and their kids are in their 60s, and their son is, I think he is the landlord to over 800 different units, he said. Mm. He has a lot of old folks housing, okay. senior housing.
Yeah.
He's very aggressive. He's very, like, businessy. And he does a lot of, he'll tell you what a good salesman he is. And actually, I recorded one of our conversations when he came to the house to do a walkthrough.
Mm-hmm. And why did you record it? Were you thinking, just to protect yourself?
Yeah, to protect myself, because he was being really sketchy in his requests. And also he was framing things as if they were positive for me, but they're really not.
Yeah.
Like, he told me that it was really good that I had kept the house so clean and had taken such good care of it because his parents needed to take a loan out on it in order to do renovations. And so they needed to pretend that his parents were living there. So I needed to put some of my bills in his parents' names. But it was really good for me because they were going to be fixing up the place.
I'm going to put the water bill in their name.
Okay.
And if you have a cable bill, do you have cable?
I have an internet. I don't have cable.
Okay. And then internet in their name. I need two bills to show in their name.
Well, could it be electric and water and power?
Electric. So they'll just get the bill and then you'll reimburse them.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah. And it would be great because I'd have a new tile and he was going to clean up the place and make it better for me. And then they were going to start building houses in front of the house I was living in. And if I was continued to be a good tenant, which I had been, then if I could have one of those houses.
I really want to sell you one of these, Kate.
Right, right.
Seriously. don't think. My sister would tell you I'm a master salesman.
Mm-hmm. It's nice meeting you.
But if anyone could carry, I trust people. And
it's a pleasure to
and sell. The biggest thing on buying a house is the down payment. Mm-hmm. And if you stay and cooperate with us and everything, we'll sell you one with no money down.
He's a salesman, huh?
Yes.
When I listened to back to that tape this morning, just to sort of hear it again, one thing that I found interesting was my own behavior in it, because I find him to be scary.
Yeah.
But he comes across as very, like, jovial and like, I'm doing the best thing for you sort of thing.
Right.
But, you know, you deconstruct it pretty quickly. And it's like, oh, you're going to be doing construction in the house while I'm living here. And also outside of the house, building more properties. And you want me to continue paying rent. And not just the same rate or a lesser rate, but you want to more than double the rent.
Yeah.
And you're telling me why that's the best thing for me. But instead of saying those things to him, I'm just going like, oh, yeah, thank you. Thanks for being so nice to me. I appreciate it.
Well, thank you for being so kind to us. Appreciate it. And talking with us about this. And
we're being fair because you've kept this place clean.
Okay.
I'm just telling you that right now. You keep it clean. You keep it in this condition. You'll never have a problem with us.
Okay. Well, I love it. I mean...
We can tell you love it.
Okay, good.
Okay?
Yeah.
I can tell you love it. I love it.
Shows. Yeah.
If I was in L.A., I'd hang out here.
Yeah, well,
I'd be smoking a doobie right down here. Okay? I'd be all over it. But unfortunately, we live in no man's land. And I try not to come to L.A. at all.
Well, cool. Well, I'll talk it over with them,
okay.
And we'll get back to you
Sounds
and let you
good.
Know what works best for us.
If you get back to us by Friday, that would be nice.
By Friday. Yeah. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's totally fair.
Okay.
And thanks for all your advice.
You know, in retrospect, I think, like, he's kind of a bully, an emotional mm-hmm. bully a bit, or at least he is to me because I have less of a backbone than he does. Would things have been different if I had, like, tried to fight him or go to court about it? But the truth is, behind the scenes, I was doing all that investigation. Like, I reached out to Joe's wife, Alex, who's a lawyer, and she helped me look at the law codes in L.A. and how they work for housing. And I realized that the landlords had been thinking about doing this for a while, because if it had been rent control, they wouldn't have been able to do these things. Wouldn't have been able to raise the rent so dramatically so quickly.
Yeah. Do you think that's why they had that other guy move out?
Yeah. So I think that's why they had the other tenant move out of the other. Because if it was two different units, then
they would not have been able to do that.
Right. So they had him move out, had me take over everything, fix that place up, which was my own doing, obviously. Mm. And what happened was that I called the Los Angeles Housing Department and actually opened a case against them and talked to them about it. And what they said was, well, even if it is, because my friend Liz was living there with her daughter at the time in the other unit.
Yeah.
And I had photos that I sent them. She's like, even if that's the case, that you have two families living in this place and there are two kitchens, if you file this report, what can happen is the landlord can tell one of you to leave. Mm. And then tear that kitchen out, and it becomes a single family residence, and is no longer rent controlled.
Is that legal for them to do that? Just kick someone out to do that? Is there like squatters' rights or something? I don't know.
I'm not. Well, she wasn't squatting. She was on the contract. She was on the lease, actually.
Yeah. I don't know.
I don't know. It just felt very...
It just felt like, I think, yeah, from what you said, it's like a lot of hoops, and it's like, this guy is a jerk, and you want to keep dealing with this guy.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Who's been obviously, like, kind of conniving this whole time.
Right. And he used, I mean, he just was hard to deal with. I mean, well, maybe someone, actually the neighbor next door to me, Michelle, had been there for, I think, 12 years, and he ended up taking him to court, and based off of a technicality, and ended up winning. And
what was the technicality again?
It was some sort of the way
like he
that...
he moved something of his property or something?
Well, what so one day, I was at, came home, and the landlord kids were in the front yard having an argument with him, like a shouting match.
Oh, God.
And the landlord kids had called me because they wanted me to move my car to park the U-Haul there that they had rented because they were taking things off of his property, and like different tubs of stored things he had under the house. And they were trying to put them into the U-Haul, and he was telling him that they couldn't do that. And the landlord was saying, well, I mean, what kind of landlord does this for a person? Like, comes takes their things away. I'm helping you.
Right.
But he was doing that so that he could have someone come out and inspect the house and figure out its value. And then I think also see if he could get a loan against it.
Yeah.
And then because of that, the neighbor filed, like, just went, took legal action and filed the suit. And then I think the landlord kids filed something incorrectly. So it became about, like, the incorrect filing of something. Mm. Anyhow, so the neighbor didn't pay rent for months, like 3 or 4 months, I think, as the case was pending. And then the day of the trial, the judge ruled that he didn't have to pay any of that back rent and he could leave anything on the property that he wanted. And he had, I think, a month and a half to get out.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, part of me is like, should I have fought harder? Did I really want to? It wasn't really worth it to me. They were going to go ahead with their plans no matter what, so I would have been in a construction zone living there. So I think I was just listening to that tape. It was like, I think I was just trying to be nice to keep things on good terms so that I could do kind of backwater dealings to figure out what are my real rights, what actions can I take.
Yeah, that's smart. I mean, you don't want to, like, just get someone who's obviously trying to take advantage of you even angrier. You know what I mean? Like, you're in a vulnerable situation, so it'd be crazy for you to... You know, it would be crazy. Just like it would, I can understand you being cautious,
right?
Which would make sense.
But yeah, at the time you're very cautious, and then once you're far away from it and in a safe place, you're like, "Why wasn't I?
Yeah, why didn't I be more of a hard ass?
Yeah, why didn't I fight harder?"
But it's like you don't have all that information. Like you weren't talking to your neighbor, so you didn't know what was going on with him,
right?
You didn't know all the specifics. You know, like you just didn't know. So. Right. And you want to give people the benefit of the doubt. And,
yeah.
You know, and also it's like sentimental because it's like so the house means something to you now. So you want to maybe stay there or you don't know. Like.
And at the time, Liz wasn't sure if she was going to stay or move out. And then she decided that, you know, she didn't want to have to deal with them and that it felt very too unstable. And she had needed more stability in her life. And so she wanted a place.
Yeah.
And also her daughter was going to be attending school in a couple of years. So she wanted a place in a better school district too. And so once she decided that she was definitely leaving and found an apartment, then that means I would be covering the full
rent.
And now it was going to be more than double. It just didn't make sense. Like, make more sense to find a place to buy where my rent would be the same as it was at that place.
Yeah.
So, but it was really stressful. It was a really stressful time. And I was okay with letting go with it in a strange way. I was like, if that's what has to happen in order for me to be the most at peace.
Yeah. Well, everyone felt that way. I mean, everyone wanted you to be okay.
Right.
You know, despite the events that we would have at Hive House and what that represented to people, you know, most importantly, we all cared about you and wanted you to feel safe and protected. And
yeah. So. I think you've described actually marriage as a lifelong art project.
Yeah.
And I feel like the 2 years that I spent there felt like it was just a really awesome art project I got to do with my friend Stacy and build a community, and that will continue, and I can let go of this. Yeah.
I feel like it's like actually like a really liberating thought to think of everything to a certain degree in that way, like without the expectations of something will lead to this or be this big thing. You know, everything has its own meaning and its own value. and you can leave it behind.
This next song is about peace activist Rachel Corrie, who died in one chapter of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and she was taken out by a bulldozer, and it's a pretty intense story, and I just remember reading about her during that time and thinking, I've never heard a song about this, I would like to hear a song about this, so... They got it too. They just keep droning and it'll be perfect. Oh, Rachel, Rachel Corrie, where are you standing now? Hopefully up in heaven, just looking kindly down. You did more than was ever asked of you. I can only wish to be half the woman as you. And you stood at the line between two worlds. When a machine made for building things put silence to your words, how could they ever think you should be killed? It's a madness over property. It's a madness of the world. I guess honesty is dangerous for those who lie. Them virtues of humility to them just don't apply. And you stood at the line, said, I will not move. Or they just came straight after you and forced your death through. Oh, Rachel, Rachel Corrie, where are you standing now? Hopefully up in heaven, just looking kindly down. One has to wonder, one has to fear, will we ever move past this phase? This one of humans killing humans, this reoccurring days. Will we ever realize that it's not good and it's not just to keep on killing, just killing, killing for the sake of trust?
So once I moved, I really kind of was trying to make peace with the idea that we wouldn't be doing Hive House events anymore because we wouldn't be close to each other. And I think part of me thought, maybe Stacey's excited that I'm moving and we don't have to do these events anymore.
Ooh, hush, 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 hush. No, no, no.
So then I was really thrilled, actually, when you reached out and said, let's do another crafts fair.
Yeah, I think the best part about what we started a few years ago is that so many people wanted the events to keep going. And a couple, our friend Linda had reached out to me about doing another craft fair, and you know, would we want to do it kind of a hive house thing, but in conjunction with Kenny and his bar? And that seemed like such a neat idea. We love Kenny and we love Linda.
They're a couple, and Kenny's a DJ and he has a club in Glendale, which is great. It's called Cure and the Cause, Cause and the Cure.
Yeah, I think it's called Cure and the Cause.
Yes.
And yeah, we just are big fans of them, and their enthusiasm just to keep Hive House going was really great. And I had kind of been wondering myself, like, what will happen? Will we have the energy to keep doing events? How will that feel? And I guess, you know, as long as there are people willing to gather, there'll be events, which is nice. Or that's how I feel about it.
Yeah. And definitely the attitude is, if events come up, we'll do them. And,
yeah.
And so far, they have.
Yeah.
Well, so it's been about 2 years we've been making this podcast together.
I know, right? It's a big time capsule. Yeah. We shouldn't release it for another 18.
Right. And then just really blow our minds.
Like a box set.
Yeah. Just keep recording.
Yeah.
For the next 18 years.
In private.
Or 20 total.
No.
And we'll just release it to the four of us.
Yeah.
But a lot has happened.
I know.
I moved out.
Do you feel like a different person?
I do feel like I've changed.
Yeah. How?
I think in the earlier episodes, I'm very, as Matt often calls it, against romance entirely. And I think that's changed. I mean, I've gotten into this relationship that's a burgeoning new thing, but...
And do you feel like a part of that is from just the Hive House and, like, just the people that you shared that space with and feeling more open to it, or?
I think our wife-adjacent relationship has allowed me to grow into having a real relationship.
I feel the
Maybe.
Same way.
I think so.
Oh, yeah. You're such a special bud.
But I don't want you to feel like I'm breaking up with you, too.
I don't ever feel that way. That's the best thing about being a life wife.
You're a life wife
for
life.
For life.
Yeah.
You can never break up.
And there's no jealousy or obligation.
That's right.
Yeah.
The opposite of a wife.
Right. You're actually supported to date other people.
Yeah, yeah. And like,
it's
definitely.
Like a polyamory relationship.
It's
where
it's kind of perfect.
Yeah. That's non-sexual with one
it's
person.
Great.
It's like
it's
a
very
friendship.
But
when you think about friendships as polyamorous relationships.
Yeah.
Where is the line exactly?
I don't know.
I've brought up polyamory a lot today.
You have. Interesting.
It is interesting.
Yeah, no, I feel like the house has been a healing house for me as well, and I feel like I've done a lot of changing and growth and figured out more of what I want and how to, you know, feel stable in my own instability, which is hard. Like, I still struggle with it, but I think knowing that you have such supportive friends, such as a life wife, makes it easier. You're never going to be stranded, no matter what.
I love you, bud.
I love you, bud.
Matt and Darren have gone through a lot of changes, too, in the last couple years.
They've taken lovers.
They've taken lovers for life.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Darren in particular. I feel like they should talk about it,
yeah,
though.
Yeah. Do you want to get on the mic and talk?
Yeah.
Do you want to?
I feel like you talk about it, especially.
We can talk about it. I'm gonna wear these.
Oh, okay.
Hey, Matt.
Hey, Darren.
So this is the first time that we've been on the mics together without Kate and Stacy. Yeah. So I think
we're very nearby.
Yeah.
Please don't. I think it's time that we let them know how we really feel about them.
Yeah, exactly. I don't know how you feel. How do you really feel?
I love them both immensely.
Wow. These are terrible confessions.
How has your life changed since the time that we started this podcast?
I have a nice girlfriend. That's pretty good.
They love her. She's great.
They love her. She's great.
She is great. I've met her also.
Yeah, Darren has also met her. I've gone through several jobs. I don't know how else. Oh, my brother moved in.
Oh, yeah.
That was
a
big thing.
Your younger brother, Alex?
My younger brother, Alex, moved into an apartment with me. And we share that now. How about you? What's new with you?
Whenever I started working on this podcast with Kate and Stacy and Matt, I think recently, or my girlfriend and I were going through some tough times, and but we persisted, and we actually just got engaged a couple weeks ago.
Yay!
since the time that I started this podcast, I also got a master's degree.
It's been a while.
And started teaching ninth grade English at Roosevelt High School in Boyle Heights. So,
congratulations.
Thank you. yeah. So we've been through some shit together.
Yeah.
I'm gonna hand the mics back over now. Yeah.
I have to say, it's been really lovely working with both of you on this project together. Yeah. And it's been cool to see how it's become what it is. Like, it's found its thing.
Yeah, I love it. We all kind of dove into it together. And look at it now. We're almost done.
Yeah. Two ladies in their mid-30s. Two guys in their mid-20s.
Hey.
Figuring it out.
What else would you want?
That's life, wife.